The material for this week's conversation from Camel Brathwaite is some of my very favorite of all of the Caribbean tradition. Brathwaite's essay, History of the Voice, which is part of the collection Roots, it's a talk that he gave that really lays out the terms of his poetics. And then the poem, The Dust, which to me is one of the more interesting poems, for me really one of the most important poems I've ever read. And when paired with History of the Voice, we get this picture or this portrait of Camel Brathwaite both as a theorist and a practitioner. That is, we get to see Brathwaite theorize the relationship between the oral, O-R-A-L, and the aural, A-U-R-A-L, right? Both speaking and hearing, and the interplay between speaking and hearing, and its force in terms of intelligence. You know, we talked a little bit about, or I alluded to mostly in class, these two notions that come together between syntactical and syllabic intelligence. For me, it's really important to think both of those things at the same time. The emphasis in History of the Voice is on the syllabic, but it's also connected, especially when we read The Dust, to syntactical intelligence. And I want to say something about that in a moment, but just in terms of the moment, the historical moment of these two pieces, they really come about at a time in the late 1960s and early 1970s when there's a profound shift in Caribbean thought, that Caribbean thought moves away from the explicitly or in some ways one-dimensional a notion of the political, an important one dimension, so I don't mean one dimension as a derisive phrase. I really mean one dimensional in terms of just the flat political struggle. How can we be independent? How can we set up political and civic institutions in order to be a post-colonial nation, to be truly independent and not, this is the one-dimensional political moment, not just a repetition in the Caribbean of our former colonizer. And that happens largely at the institutional level, as well as the economic negotiations and reconfigurations that are so important in the immediate post-colonial moment and for decades after, really even through today, for sure. That is, in the economic and the political questions of the politics of post-coloniality, you get a set of concerns that are about how to set up institutions and relations between nations that doesn't replicate colonial domination and colonial rule. Now, for me, it's important, obviously that's important work, and I don't think anyone would ever dispute that. But what's important as a follow-up or a companion piece to that work is the dimensionality of culture. In some ways, I think we can look at the Caribbean today and see that for so many countries, not all of course, but for so many countries, the moment of independence has come and passed, and that politically they are certainly very independent, right? That you know, some islands and nations are still part of the colonial nation or have relationships to colonial power, like departmentalization of Dominica and Guadeloupe and Martinique, the status as a territory of Puerto Rico, you know, the special relationships that you know, Barbados and Jamaica have, and as well as the Bahamas have with England, you know, and the Virgin Islands, both the British Virgin Islands with England, the U.S. Virgin Islands with the United States. These are all politically compromised nations at one level, and they've negotiated that, and that's a political question on the side of our conversations in this class or in this series of process pieces. But it is important for me to note that those relationships, having been negotiated and renegotiated over decades, really revolve around the independence of civic institutions and economic relations. What is not a part of that, largely, and what has in some ways been left behind, but also developed, fully developed. So I think it's interesting the way it's both under-integrated, but overly, overly developed compared to its deployment in civic life, is the cultural question. And what I mean by that is that writers have been talking about vernacular languages as what Brathwaite calls in History of the Voice, a nation language. Like how to think about, what if we took Patois and Creoles and Pidgins as national languages rather than languages that you speak at home, but once you leave the home into an education system or into a workplace or a government workplace, they get left behind for the colonial language. That's been so deeply examined, debated, criticized, processed across decades, really initiated in many ways by Brathwaite's early work as well as Glissant's early work. But it hasn't shown up in civic institutions at all, right? And in some ways, I think the history of the Caribbean since independence, the independence era, has been a history of denying access to vernacular culture at the civic level. And in that way, the neocolonial realities of cultural life and civic life so come together in this clash, right? That we have very post-colonial notions at the level of the arts and at the level of cultural production around vernacular languages. But in terms of civic life is cut off from those, except insofar as it can be used as a promotion for, for tourism or for heritage sites or just for generally an appreciation of the richness of, say, Bajan culture and literature, Jamaican literature and culture and so forth. So you have at this moment when Brathwaite is writing History of the Voice and when he's writing The Dust, you have this very important moment of the Caribbean negotiating its civic and economic, the terms of its civic and economic independence. I say the terms of because what independence means is part of what's being discussed at the political level. But what he wanted to propose in terms of culture is something that really never quite achieves its political prominence and its political place in the way that somebody like Brathwaite wanted. And for that reason, I think just the phrase nation language is so important for Brathwaite. It's so important because it reintroduces questions of culture to national political practice. And if culture informs national political practice around questions of language, this notion of nation language is exactly a way of naming, what is our nation language? What is the thing that makes us a people and a nation that's unlike others and not just simply a mirror distorted or pure of another culture, right? Whether it's other islands or whether it's the colonial power. The question of the colonial power and its presence, its spectral presence in contemporary political life and cultural life is, of course, the primary concern. But in making this argument for nation language, I think what I find most interesting about Brathwaite's exposition, and this gets back to the questions of syntactical and syllabic intelligence, is that in order to talk about a nation language, Brathwaite actually has a very high standard, if you want to call it that, or a high sense of measure for what would constitute a nation language. So for Brathwaite, he in no way wants to say that a nation language is just what people speak, right, or just how they sound when they speak. So it's not oral, A-U-R-A-L, in the sense of just whatever the sound of the island is, but rather the sense in which the oral and aural, right, the speaking and the hearing bear within it a specific kind of intelligence. And that's part of why I wanted to watch that interview from University of Miami with Edward Baugh, where Brathwaite is very clear about, he's very clear about the question of intelligence and how the question of language can't simply be a matter of accent, but rather, and this is his history of becoming, his personal narrative of his history of becoming a poet. Because his history of becoming a poet is not I'm Camel Brathwaite, and I just made my poetry. His story of becoming a poet is I'm Camel Brathwaite, and I had to overcome the limits of what England could teach me about being a Caribbean poet. And the limits of what England could teach in terms of becoming a Caribbean poet lies in just that question of, do we have the words and figures of speech and metaphors and imagery out of England's English to describe Caribbean landscapes, Caribbean reality, and Caribbean experience? The answer to that is no. And I think this is makes for a really interesting way of rereading so much of Brathwaite's poetry that predated History of the Voice, to read Derek Walcott's poetry, to read Edouard Glissant's poetry, and to notice, and it's really noticeable once you've read Brathwaite, to notice just how often and with what precision all three of them, just to pick those three because we've read them, with what precision they all seek names for vegetation, right? For natural phenomena, whether it's the sound of waves, the look of the sea, the sounds of music and instruments, the smell of the air, the density of the air, the character of the sun. All of these things require words. That's the intelligence. That intelligence isn't here, you know, syntactical or syllabic intelligence, meaning, I don't know, like, you know, you say them smartly, or you say them with a plan, or you say them with a kind of precision. Rather, really what Brathwaite is getting at is that the intelligence lies in their descriptive capacity, and not just a generalized descriptive capacity, but the way that words, the way they sound, and the way they are arranged, right? The syllabic and the syntactical. The way that words are arranged and spoken is essential to knowing. So that's the intelligence part. It's epistemological. In order to know self, in order to know world, in order to know self and world together, you need a different vocabulary, and that vocabulary is not available in the English language, or it is not readily available in terms of how people speak. And so then there's also that shift of dimension for Brathwaite that I think is really important, that he articulates with a clarity I haven't seen in other writers, which is that everyday people speak in ways that already embody syllabic and syntactical intelligence. That is, they already have names for what is around them. The problem is that those names that they have for the world that is around them, when they go to school, right? When they go to write, when they go to do some formal public articulation of their world, you know, whether it's a novel, a short story, a journalistic story, a poem, a play, the reversion happens immediately to European English or European French and all the other languages. I mean, Brathwaite's very clear about that too, but goes to England English. And in that moment of wanting to make a formal declaration, an intelligent declaration of what myself and my world is. And in that way, I think it draws out, when we see that happen, we see drawn out into the open this idea, very colonial and colonized idea, of what intelligence is. That what intelligence is a proximity to the kinds of language that the British use. Brathwaite's proposal is that intelligence is not in the sort of racial history of who uses the language, which is, that's the claim that England's English carries an intelligence that other bits of, of broken or rotten English can't, right? That you have to perfect the proper, you have to perfect diction, all of these things that we talked about previously with Frantz Fanon. I mean, in some ways, he's calling out Fanon for still having a colonial vision of language. So if we relocate intelligence away from racial national origins and resonance to the capacity of people to name themselves, their world, and their relationship to the world, that sense of relationality in language and in words, then you can see how the syntactical, right, how you arrange words on a page, how you arrange words in a way that sings, you know, poetry as sung speech, the way it sings, but also then the syllabic, right, how you actually say those words and how they have to be spelled differently when written, and how their different writing invokes a sense of orality. This is why I liked pairing it with the dust. I like pairing it with the dust, History of the Voice essay with the dust, because what the dust does when you read it, I think, and I was curious to hear how other people encountered the poem. It seemed like this was generally a similar experience. Whereas you're reading, you find yourself needing to say the words out loud if it's not your vernacular. Now, if it is your vernacular, I'm very curious what that's like. Right? What is it like to be, you know, Bajan or Jamaican, and to hear in that, to read in that English, your own voice in your head? But for those of us who don't have that voice in the head, I think we actually catch sight very quickly of how important the oral is, that the written can't quite tell us what the words are and what they're trying to do. But if we hear them, whether we read them out loud to ourselves or have a loud voice in our heads as we read, or, and we're lucky this way, we are able to get Brathwaite's own recording of his own reading of it, we can hear exactly how those words are spoken. Now, when I say how they are spoken, I really mean not just, I don't mean just, you know, that Brathwaite has a, you know, a Bajan accent, and so, you know, it's accented, and so it sounds like it's written. It's not just the sound, but rather how the sound and the word and its meaning and its impact is also embedded in orality, in its being spoken and its being heard, its orality. So that's where the intelligence comes out in the syllabic, right? We have the syntactical when the poem is written, but we have the syllabic in that moment, both when it's written, but the way something is written, the poem is written, to provoke a reading at some point. That in some ways, I think for me, the written version of the dust is only for Bajans. Maybe also for other Anglophone nations, but really for Bajans. That's where it's written from, about, and to Barbados. And so when we think about Barbados as the origin and destination of the poem, right, what we need is it being read by him. Right? We need it being read by somebody who understands the connection between the syntactical, the syllabic, the oral, and the aural. And that's what Brathwaite's reading does. As I said in class, I mean, it's one of the things I really love about the poem and about the reading of it is that he is a good reader. He's not just a good reader, because some people are good readers, some people are just okay, some people are terrible readers. Any of us who have had to read out loud in a group of people know this about ourselves. Like, some of us are really good at it, some of us really struggle. But his good reading is not that sort of, does he have a flair for it? He's a good reader because he understands and works inside that sense of orality, right? Both speaking and sound and hearing, right? Speaking and hearing both at the same time. So hearing him read it and then listening to Merle Collins read it is really interesting for me for a couple of levels. There's one, the sort of cultural political question, which is, what does it mean for the dust to be read by a man? It's a poem about women. And to be written, read by a woman. What does it mean that the poem is written by a man about women? And what does it mean for a poem written about a man about by a man about women to be read by a woman? So there's an interesting cultural politics of both representation and performance there that we could make it an ethical question, or we could make it an aesthetic question. You know, what is gained by Collins reading and what is gained by Brathwaite reading? And vice versa, what is lost in each case. So for me, that's where we get into a really interesting phase of literary critique, right? So literary criticism as examining the conditions of the possibility of expressive culture. You know, how deeply connected is the poem to its spoken sound? How connected is the poem to the gender of its author and to its subject matter? And how transferable and translatable is the poem across islands? You know, I didn't just pick Merle Collins because that was one that was available online or because she's, you know, Professor Emeritus in the English department. I picked it because she's from Grenada, and so she speaks a different kind of English. And hearing her different English reckon with an English that's been made vernacular and transformed by Brathwaite in the act of writing, right? The act of writing, that translation of English into vernacular, it's a translation of vernacular into written, and then a retranslation of the written into the spoken. And that retranslation is both gendered and nationalized. And it shows both the expansive character of nation language, that nation language may be, in the Anglophone Caribbean, something akin to Benitez Rojo's repeating island, that every island is different, but it's also repeating the same island. So maybe there's this dimension in which Collins is able to capture something just as essential as Brathwaite because of this phenomenon of the repeating island. But it might also be that the nature the intimacy of nation and language is also, that it doesn't have to be an either or, is also primarily a question of the nation from and to which, from and toward which it is written and therefore to be spoken. We only can figure that out by sitting with the two readings for a long time, contemplating them, and I think discussing it, right? Debating it, negotiating these differences. Now, I don't have a settled view on this. I mean, I would share my settled view if I had it. I don't know if it would be interesting. But I think it's such a crucial question because it really gives us a chance to move beyond tropes and theoretical claims about the relationship of the oral to nation, to identity, to place, to history, and to memory, to move away from the to move the theoretical into a sense of practice. That's actually what praxis with an X, praxis is. Praxis, people, I find it just started to use that term as a synonym for practice. But practice has a kind of naivete built into it, right? That it is not explicitly theoretically informed. Theory has it's theoretical. It doesn't have a practical dimension built into it. And praxis is that blending of both theory and practice at the same time and thinking them together. And that's what the dust and history of the voice do when you pair them, is it makes for praxis at the level of poetics. And in being praxis at the level of poetics, I think Brathwaite lets us ask with real concrete content, but also deep cultural force, ask the questions that have dominated so many of our previous readings and so many that are to follow. Namely, when we look at the practices of speech, when we theorize nation and language, when we look for colonial specters and try to purge the post-colonial nation and its culture of those specters, what are we left with? Right? How do we discern and manifest the intelligence of vernacular languages, of everyday speech and everyday people? In that way, it's so important that the dust is not an abstraction. It's literally a conversation between women standing outside of a corner store. And it moves from our immersion into their culture of sound, right? How they sound talking to each other, and the poem really embodies that so well, and then transitions into all the things that we would want to think about when we think about intelligence, right? We think about encounters with our own mortality, like how do we think about death? How do we think about hope? How do we think about the body? How do we think about gender? I think the poem thinks gender in a really important way. And how does, and you know, we can list all of these things out of the dust. I think that's part of what a close reading would do. How can we actually draw out a whole philosophical system? That is a whole system of wisdom about the meaning and nature of life. How can we draw that out of the sound of the poem? Not that the poem is so abstract that it's like philosophy. The opposite. that it is so concrete and so material in its sound that it makes its intelligence visible to us, felt by us, palpable, fills us maybe with terror, with sadness, with joy, with melancholy, like all sorts of things, right? But it fills us with that because the sound of the poem, right, the syllabic and syntactical intelligence of the poem conveys ideas. And to think vernacular language that way is where, in the end, Brathwaite has his ultimate response to somebody like Fanon, who disparaged Creole and Pidgin languages. And he disparaged them because he saw them only as derivative of colonial languages. Whereas Brathwaite is upending that idea of the center of the colony and its language, or the colonial colonizer and its language, and then the margins is how the colonized speak. Obliterating that center margin relationship is really what marks History of the Voice and The Dust as post-colonial. That it gets outside that logic of center and margin and just says, let's listen for the intelligence. Let's let these women spin a philosophical story in 6 pages of verse. And out of those 6 pages of verse, let's take the lesson that vernacular language bears intelligence in it. And in that way, we, speaking from Brathwaite's perspective and in Brathwaite's voice, it's the case that we don't need anything more than the language we already have and the people we already are.